Thank you.
Okay.
So the first three questions go together, just what is your age, racial and ethnic identification, and gender?
I turned 66 yesterday. Happy birthday to
Happy
me.
Happy birthday.
gender, male. What's the other question? I guess ethnicity.
How you identify.
White, Caucasian, however you want to do that.
All right. And just to start, again, getting a background of you, apologies if you put this in that summary.
Doesn't matter.
But if you could tell us about your formal education.
Bachelor of Science and Engineering from Princeton University, 1972.
And your profession at the moment?
Combination of retired and consultant. I do a bunch of consulting.
Great. So starting at the beginning, I guess, right out of college, what were some of your first jobs prior to coming to EPA?
I came straight here.
You did come straight here.
Yeah. Well, EPA was formed in 1970.
Yes.
And I graduated, you know, from a high-end university engineering degree in 1972. I had several job offers from EPA. Well, the way to put it is when EPA was formed, I was in college and I knew what I wanted to do, and that was to go work for EPA. So I came to EPA, should have brought it to show you, but I have, but my badge, because EPA was being created, it was kind of agglomerated from different pieces of different, you know, different bureaus and things and different agencies put together in different buildings around the Washington area. And so I'd had a job offer from a, one of the job offers I got from EPA was here in the DC area in air pollution enforcement. So I came here straight here as a GS5 step one. And my badge number, which I'm very proud of, is 399.
Wow.
Of all of them they ever issued, I still have it.
So that means you were the 399th
yep.
person ever.
That they gave a badge to, right.
That's amazing.
Right.
Right. So
I was here from the very beginning. Here from the very beginning.
And you said in college you had your eyes set on the EPA right away.
Oh, yeah. It was created. I knew what I wanted to do.
What made your interest peak in that?
Well, I was... In engineering in the early 70s was all about aerospace, electrical, especially emergence of computing as a potential kind of line of inquiry, and other stuff which I was not interested in. So between aerodynamics and electrical stuff, I didn't like either one of them. What I liked was law.
Okay.
And so I got really interested in legal issues, and particularly the use of water rights and water use and pollution emerged in the early 70s of water as a real problem. I wrote my thesis on that. And EPA was formed right in the middle. And it was like, eureka, like
wow.
Bingo, hello.
Yeah.
So it was so clear.
Wow.
So I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I came here, and that's what I did.
Were a lot of people on campus actually looking towards that, or was it more of an...
As far as I know, I'm the only one.
Wow. But for you, that sounds like...
Right. Well, this is... See, I was in the last class... You were Harvard, right?
Yes, I was.
I was in the last class at Princeton that was all male.
Oh, wow.
And I was
like... That's amazing, too.
Well, what was really amazing is I came from West Texas, a little small town, and I didn't even know it was all male. I got there and discovered there were no girls. So it was like, I think I made a big mistake.
And then it
but
changed.
But then, you know, while I was there, co-education started. Same with Harvard, same with
and
Yale.
It amazes me actually how late Radcliffe was. I think it was 1991 that Radcliffe stopped giving out diplomas. The Harvard counterpart.
I thought Radcliffe still did give out diplomas.
They finally changed it to all Harvard.
Oh, okay.
I think
it's not you could just like Barnard. You could still do it if you want to.
Maybe, but at least right now they have the actual Harvard name on it.
Yeah, I was to say it's all the same time. But anyway, just in the middle of that, lots of change going on. Vietnam War, you know, I was draft eligible, draft age. The other stories around that. But it was just so clear from the beginning.
That's great.
That this is an area that needed work. I loved it. Like I said, I wrote my thesis on this without knowing what I was going to do. Rights and water use.
You actually got to continue. Did you continue any work similar to your thesis? Then
I ended up doing that. But I started off in air.
Okay.
Doing air enforcement, copper smelters. I mean, this is a time it was particulate matter was just I mean, the predecessor of the Clean Air Act was it was state-driven, same with the Water Act. It was all state-driven. States had set their ambient air standards. They could do what they wanted to do. And the imposition of a federal superstructure over it happened in 1970 for air and then 1972 for water. But I started with air. And so it was the first imposition of federal oversight on states and sort of federal standardization, if that's the right word, is just sort of like setting minimums where the states had to perform within them. Mm-hmm. And so I was working on enforcement and trying to make sure the rules that EPA did were enforceable. And this is when Nixon was president. Bill Ruckelshaus was at EPA the first time. It was a great time. I mean, I was a GS, like, I mean, I was five technically. It was like getting paid nothing. Literally $100 a week was the take home.
But it was something you were interested in.
I loved it. I loved my entire career there. Yeah. Loved it. Still do.
There's a lot to talk about. This is great. You mentioned federal, this was the first time there was sort of standardization of looking at water programs and air programs.
Right.
What was the general sentiment at the time for people working in the EPA about that? You said you were excited, but do you feel like...
Well, it's hard to answer that question precisely. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to look at your phone.
I'm just going to put it down so it doesn't buzz.
It's hard to say, because I was just this little schmuck. You know, I was off in this little office in Rockville. Mm-hmm. Before this whole complex was created by Carol Browner, we were all down at Waterside Mall.
I heard about that.
Yeah. This is before that.
Oh, wow.
This is why they were building Waterside Mall. Spiro Agnew's nephew was developing that thing. And it was non-compliant with all kinds of code. It had all kinds of problems to it. But we were literally in different buildings all around the area because there had never been an EPA. They just created it. They just took these, like, you know, pesticides. It was an ag. The air office where I was was an office or kind of a bureau in HEW, but they were physically separated. So I was actually up in Rockville. To answer your question, I had no clue. I didn't even know where these other parts of EPA were.
Because they were separate still.
Much less people who were more senior or anything. Wow. All I knew was it was a wide open field. People were more than willing to let you do what made sense. There was the law. The Clean Air Act was in place.
Yeah.
People working on regs. Regs had to get out. They all had deadlines. Managers were responsible. It was a good time. It was fine. It was absolutely fine. Even though Nixon was president, he had vetoed the Clean Air Act, vetoed the Clean Water Act, vetoed the creation of EPA. And so he was not like exactly a friend or anything, but he's also so remote that it made no difference.
That's interesting. I think I'm just going to jump into this before we get off
the
topic.
We should do it, because I can rattle.
I can talk. I love it.
I'm sorry.
But you mentioned, so all these offices were segmented. Can you tell me about then what it was like when they all came to, I guess it would have been Waterside?
To Waterside Mall?
Yeah. How that changed your feeling of working there?
I would say. There was a better sense, I mean, Waterside Mall, you've been down there, right? You've been to Nationals Park.
I've seen it, yeah.
Just from the outside now, it's all split down 4th Street. Well, it used to have this,
yeah.
It also kind of be one kind of building. It was a really crappy space. But it was still a feeling of cohesion, I guess is the best word to use. There was a general feeling of being able to connect better to other parts of the agency. For example, the planning office, budget, stuff like that you had to deal with all the time. Because to do a reg, you know, you're a GS5 sitting off your corner, you type this stuff, you do these things. Mm-hmm. The process would go forward, but to kind of physically be around the people that had to pass on. For example, general counsel is probably the best example. Mm-hmm. To have general counsel in the same place where your lawyers would be there. You could just walk down the hall and say, "Are you out of your mind? What did you just do to this rig?" And they say, "Oh," and you go, "Oh, well, actually, it makes sense." And, you know, so to have a discussion with people
Because you see them in the same place.
If what you're fishing for or kind of thinking
curious,
about
honestly.
Is possible, possible ways in which it didn't work or there were problems with it, I just wouldn't say that. It was... somebody's going somewhere. But it was a constructive time. Mm-hmm. Just you felt like a little mole in a maze and
well, an exciting maze. It sounds like
it was pretty cool. It had a lot of power. I mean, honestly, it's a GS probably 7 at this point. I wrote the asbestos demolition rig.
Wow!
I wrote it. I didn't know anything about this, but it had to get out. Had to have a had to be done by a certain day. So I wrote it.
Wow, that is a lot of power.
Yeah, it's
amazing.
A lot of power. It felt great. I loved it.
That's really good. Jumping back towards these, so you talked a little bit about when you first joined the agency. You were excited about that. What, I guess this is more for just when we, if we talk about you.
Yeah, the, your research. You can do whatever you need to.
What was the name of the first group that you were working with, just so I can have that on
the timeline? It was the Division of Stationary Source Enforcement. And I'm going to send to you now, the resume has some of the stuff way back in distant past. I don't have...
I'm sure it's a lengthy resume at this point.
Well, just the ancient history stuff I've done. But at the time, it was the office... It was the Division of Stationary Source Enforcement in the Office of General Counsel and Enforcement. That was the assistant administrator. They had enforcement and general counsel all together, all the lawyers, both enforcement and general counsel, were all together. And this was on the general, this was on the enforcement side.
And how big was that group?
Heck if I know.
No, that's fine.
I guess
or people that you
people?
Worked with, maybe.
30 people,
30
maybe.
People. Okay.
By group, that's the division I was in.
Yeah.
Probably 30 people in the division. That handled all the enforcement issues for all enforcement stationary sources, factories, power plants, steel mills, all that kind of stuff. What I'm doing is just sending you... No, I'm not. It's not going.
That's fine. I can also check later.
I just want to do it before I forget it.
If we have these written down, I can stress that less. And focus more just on your actual experiences. But just to make sure to have the context would be useful. Thank you.
Well, I can't work my phone. I'll send it to you.
That's
okay.
So just to, I guess, get at this point one more time before moving on to sort of latter jobs after the Nixon administration, during that first time when you first started at the EPA, how did you see your individual role as part of the greater context of the organization? And you touched on parts of this, so sorry if I'm repeating it, but...
Well,
just
sort of. I mean, a role with an organization depends so much on mm-hmm. kind of your personality and the people around you.
Yes.
And I'm an extrovert to begin with. You know, I'll talk to anybody about anything. So I was outgoing, talking to people, really engaged, really excited about this stuff, smart enough to keep track of all the stuff. I read the law, you know, I got it.
Yeah.
And so I stood out, honestly. And the people around me were far more experienced at senior levels. They had come from HEW,
mm-hmm.
and they had been working air pollution for a while. They understood what needed to be done. And they were able to use me in a really constructive way. I mean, honestly, I give them the credit. There's a guy in particular named Dick Wilson, who became a deputy assistant administrator for air. He left probably in... I think when Carol Browner was here. Great, great, great man. He's still around somewhere. But he just kind of found talent where it was. That's mm-hmm. how he even learned about management.
Oh, wow.
Because he just says, I'm the schmuck. I'm trying to do stuff, make stuff out of asbestos rule and smelters, tall stacks. The whole thing at the time was, well, we don't need to put in pollution control. We'll just build a taller stack. Because
okay.
it's for ambient air, so if you
right.
build a taller stack and it kind of goes out, you don't have to put any pollution control. And that wasn't what the law said, and yada, yada, yada. So I was really right. involved in the rules and that. And so people around me nurtured me in a really good way to understand kind of what needed to be done, what success was. This guy, Dick Wilson, who was the division director at the time and then rose up through the through the ranks to be a DAA for quite a long time for air. They kind of helped me find my place in a way in which I was able to contribute. I was rewarded with raises on time and promotions and all that sort of stuff and more challenging jobs. I loved it. It was great.
Really good mentorship from them.
Fantastic.
So from somebody starting out from college, like you said, what did they sort of envision for you or help you pursue in those first couple of years that you were there?
Well, it was sink or swim, absolutely.
Really?
It's like, we got to get this rule out.
Otherwise, what would happen?
There was no otherwise.
It had
to go out. I don't even know what otherwise would have been.
Who were the people from above who were telling you to sort of pursue that?
Well, I'm a flunky. There are these kind of couple levels of lower management in between, and then Dick was the division director, 30 to 40 people maybe, directing all enforcement for all stationary sources. But stuff had to get done. Yeah, and these are deadlines, the rule's going out. And it is going out, and it's got to be finished. So it's late nights, early mornings, working on talking to people, general counsel, getting the lawyers involved so they can sign off on it before it went out the door and so forth. But there was no failure. You had to do
That's
it,
great.
And I did.
That is interesting to me just in terms of, these deadlines of when the law has to be put
big
out.
Big time, big time.
Do you think, and it's fine if you don't know the answer to this, but who sort of at the very top level of that chain was pushing for these deadlines?
I do not know.
That's probably further up.
I assume it was because the way both Water Act and the Air Act are structured, and not so much any of the others, but the rule-driven statutes passed in the early 70s all had statutory deadlines. They were mandatory duties. The administrator shall by a certain date. And the liability was quite clear that if it was not done by that date, then the agency could be sued.
Wow, that's so the EPA.
To compel the rule. And the politics of that are bad. Because Nixon had vetoed all kinds of stuff coming up for that time. He hadn't resigned yet, but he was still trying to position things right. And they needed those rules out. They just needed them out. They were not going to subject the administrator to a court order for failure to perform.
So the administrator actually could have been sued.
Yeah, and of course was many times. Later on in the Water Act, under the Water Office, I was responsible for all the water rules and most of them, but by that time were under court order.
Oh, wow.
Where the agency had previously failed to get them out. So we had court orders out our ears and that stuff. So there's a lot of pressure to get stuff done in the rules.
I'll probably get to this, but when the court order that you didn't get out, what were sort of the things precipitating that? After that?
Am I in the 70s? Am I in the air or later?
Let's actually get to that later, I think. I think
that's more later,
because
you were asking sort of what the motivation was, what happened if you didn't.
I'll get to that.
But that is less of an issue now. There's still some of it. If we want to jump really fast forward to the current administration, my successor here is in charge of the Water Act, and I talk to her all the time. Talked to her this afternoon. They've got court deadlines, and they are sweating buckets about what the current budget passback and all the rest means in terms of the court orders. And so, but that it just simply is the way the Water Act and the Air Act especially are set up. The others, not so much.
Okay.
TSCA, CERCLA, FIFRA, the other major environmental acts, not so much. But water and air are really deadline driven. And that was a big deal at the beginning. So we may be spending more time in this than we need to.
Yeah.
But that's sort of what it was about at the time, is just getting the damn things out. They had to be done. They just had to be.
So we can move forward a little bit. So you started, you said, in water in this division 1972 when
air.
You graduated. Oh, sorry, I apologize.
Yeah.
Air when you graduated.
Right,
even
72.
Your thesis
there for
water.
4 years. and then, I think in 76 I moved to water.
Okay. And what happened with that move?
Why that was me. That was 100% me.
Okay.
Because I had already sort of gotten to the point where I understood air.
Got it.
I didn't like it. air, I thought was sort of unnecessarily complicated.
What was complicated about it?
Oh, it wasn't. How well do you know the statute, the Clean Air Act?
I know the basics.
Well, it wasn't just, you know, the state implementation plans for achieving ambient air quality standards, and it wasn't just the performance standards, which I'd worked on for smelters and things like that. It was also unbelievable trivia on air quality maintenance areas.
Oh, okay.
And maintaining things after you got there, and the level of trivia that began to descend, particularly from the state implementation plans, got to the point where I just thought it was stupid.
Too detailed, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Too detailed.
Yeah, it was a lot of. It was very, very fussy. Would be the best way to put it. Still
That's
is.
Interesting.
It's extremely. I mean, anti-degradation. So once you achieve something, you have to have entire plans for not only maintaining it,
right,
but then making sure, in addition, that you don't have degradation. And
that's
you know, they all have their own thing, and they have their own structures, and so forth. And that just wasn't sort of where my mindset was. I'm just a sort of a doer.
So you moved into
moved water. Where they were working at that time on a whole set of whole raft of rules called effluent guidelines. You ever heard of those?
Yeah.
Which are the performance standards for all the major industrial categories. And I liked metals.
Okay.
I mean, I liked steel. I liked copper smelt. I liked primary, secondary, all the smelting stuff. I liked metal. It was really basic. It was primal, almost, to me. But I got really involved in some of those things from the air side, and then was recruited and accepted a job over in the water office to get out their rules on smelters and on steel. So did all the steel rules, did all the
and what,
primary copper rules, all that stuff.
What division was that? With water.
Effluent Guidelines Division, they called it at the time. It's now called, and I was there, I mean, ended up responsible for all this stuff. Not AED. What did we call it? Yeah, that's right, AED. Analysis and Engineering Division.
Okay.
Is what it's now called.
AED. And so when you first started your work with water, you said effluent guidelines, you were working with smelting in factories.
Yeah.
Was that what your major project was surrounding?
Yeah.
So actually putting out regulations.
Putting out the
about
rules.
That.
I love the rules.
Wow.
It was great.
That's cool. And this was
what's great.
Time.
You get to, I mean, it's hard to explain.
It matters. It's something that you
it matters in tangible. The first instance, but just the physical part of this to me was just really, really fun.
That's
like
cool.
Yeah, because you get to go into all these factories.
Oh wow. And actually see where the things
unbelievable.
Are.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, I just wish I'd had a GoPro camera for all those years. Because, like, I mean, for example, copper smelters, and there's only one left in the country now. They've all gone out of business now, not because of environmental rules, but because of Brazil.
Oh.
South American, really Chilean. Copper prices. It's just they're a quarter of the price of that copper could command here. But anyway, what they used to be were these buildings. And I'm just estimating how tall that building is right there. I would say that they were as tall. They were six, seven stories tall. And maybe a football field long.
Wow.
And they would house like six copper converters. And these copper converters were 15 feet in diameter. Big drums. 15 feet in diameter, 30 to 40 feet long. And they were these big drums with a big kind of outlet on top.
Okay.
And literally they'd kind of rotate around these gigantic cogs.
Wow.
And, you know, they would kind of rotate up and they would use immense amounts of ore.
Wow.
At about, it'd been concentrated, so it was about 20% ore would go in there. Copper was the primary thing. And then all kinds of flux and all kinds of additional kinds of stuff they'd throw in there. Then that hood would come down on it. An immense hood, bigger than four or five of these offices
That's
would come down.
The scale of that.
The scale was just unbelievable. And we're talking that kind of building with just six of them in it.
With moving parts.
All on the bias. And they'd fire it for like 12, 13 hours or so. and there was all kind of slagged and molten stuff in there, then the whole entire, the hood would come up, the whole entire thing would rotate out. They'd pour it off into these giant crucibles, which would then fly up into the air and go. It was incredible.
So seeing that.
No kidding. That's what I mean. It was really fun.
I would have wanted to see that.
No kidding. Just once in a lifetime kind of stuff. Wow. So I loved it. Still do.
And it so the really job good. Involved actually getting to go to these factories.
Physically there.
Wow.
Physically there. And talking to people. I did public hearings. You go to the public hearings where people were worried about losing their jobs.
Okay.
EPA, and we're talking, you know, rural Arizona, right at the border of Mexico, really small towns. You know, be lead and all kinds of stuff, and school grounds and all kinds of other problems around just from the air pollution. But
and why were they worried about losing their jobs?
They were afraid of it.
They were afraid of the smelter?
Of the federal EPA coming in.
Okay.
They're gonna do these rules. They're gonna lose their jobs. Who cares about the damn smoke? It goes into Mexico anyway.
Right.
The prevailing winds are north to south, and we're on the Mexican border. Literally, this is a Douglas. This is a Phelps Dodge Douglas. The winds would be prevailing to the south, and so the argument was, we don't care.
Who cares?
We live here. Cows don't eat this.
Wow.
We need our jobs.
So what do you say to that?
Hmm?
What would you say at these hearings?
You have to listen. You have to listen.
When they would
you have
do
to
this.
Listen because you hadn't made up your mind. You didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. I'm just a schmuck. I'm just the engineer in the job. You know, I'm not actually the guy that makes the decision. I'm part of the process.
A very well educated.
But I'm listening. Well, you know, but I'm listening. I don't.
Yeah.
I can't say, oh, sure, you're right. I'll stop this.
Your fears are.
The law is the law. The law's got to get done. There's got to be a way here. And so then it ends up being sort of a balancing thing at the end about, well, you have choices on what you can put into the rig, ranging from do nothing and leave it just like it is to, you know, to some, you know, zero discharge, in the case of water, zero discharge, which is shut it down, and the kind of steps you can do in between, and then the money, the benefits, all that kind of stuff has to be balanced in between. So you listen.
Yeah.
And you talk to people. So as an education, it was wonderful. I loved it.
Did you do a lot of these public hearings?
Yeah. All of them.
All of them. In what
for copper
general
smelters.
Locations? In the locations?
They're most of the West. They're almost all in the West. There are just a couple in the East.
So you were traveling quite a bit, too,
yeah.
this time. This job was still based in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay. So you had to go to the sites and see these hearings. This is actually interesting to me,
it
though,
was fun.
As well, with people worried about, I mean, even now, the EPA coming in and having
changed.
Regulations that would lose their jobs.
It hasn't changed. And they're
Do you
right.
think that the answer is any different then versus now for how people would address that?
Maybe, well, I don't know, to be honest. Because then there are other forces at play that don't exist now, especially the market. I mean, maybe it exists in coal. Coal is probably the closest you can get.
Mm-hmm.
Where the jobs have been lost in coal country and for mountaintop mining or anything like that, those jobs, you know, people blame the EPA for it, but those jobs left not because of EPA, but because of the market. It's cheaper to buy gas, and so they do. It's market forces. And guess what? They don't buy your coal.
Yeah.
And so EPA was a small part of that in coal. And the same is true for in the copper rules I did. We were not the reason those smelters closed. It was a drop in price as far cheaper imports came in. The difference probably is we avoided the blame. We were not blamed. People understood it more for what it was. And,
in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And 80s by this time.
80s. How, I guess this is a very broad question, so it's fine if you don't have an exact answer, but what was the general public sentiment towards the EPA as far as your job was concerned at that time? You said people didn't blame the EPA as much. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I can't generalize.
Is it a generalization?
Because the EPA is just such a big place, and there's so many different things that affect people mm-hmm. that I was not involved in and didn't have experience in. But for the areas I worked in, especially water through the 70s, the attitude was not antagonistic. The environmental movement had awoken.
Right.
People were aware of things like cancer and connection to pollution, to you know, things that happen to bodies. A lot of people in this world have cancer, and people have died from it. And so to say, well, you know, this doesn't mean anything. That wasn't the narrative at all.
Yeah.
It was more that pollution kills people
and harms things. To things like cancer. That they were drawing the link between things like cancer and that.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And there was a more, I wouldn't say it's an informed link, but it was more, you're asking about attitudes. The attitudes were more like, this is something that will help people and it's probably worth doing, even if it costs some people some jobs. It was not, but it just wasn't antagonistic, nothing like it is right now.
And you feel like now it is more antagonistic. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but just saying
by
that.
Far, yeah. By far, by far.
I am jumping ahead with this, but just
we can do that.
What we're talking
I've got time, but you need to manage things, so I'm leaving it to you.
I just don't want to keep you too late, but we're good for now.
Told you, I could go on for a long time.
With people, you said it is antagonistic now. In what ways have you felt that being manifested?
Well, why don't we do the in-between just a little bit?
That makes sense.
Because I had talked about moving on to the water office in the late
70s. Yeah, 1976.
Right. I actually left the agency for a few years during the Reagan administration.
Okay.
During that transition, I was working for UNEP, United Nations Environment Program.
And what made you want to work for them during that time period? You said UNEP, what years was that?
'82 to 1984. I did consulting with UNEP and also with USAID, setting up their industrial pollution control program in Indonesia.
Oh wow! And where, location-wise, where did that job bring you?
In Jakarta.
In Jakarta.
Yeah, and I was based in Nairobi for UNEP.
Wow.
It was pretty fun.
What? I mean, this is just really interesting that you took that 2 years. What do you feel like, I guess what brought you, wanted to bring you to that job?
To make the change?
Yeah.
Well, that's, you're asking what was great about what I did there, or are you asking about why I made the change? Those are two different things.
Why you made the change?
It was time for that, I think. It was time for change. By that time, I'd been at EPA about 10 years.
Yeah.
And to the time of, is this really what I want to do? Meanwhile, Reagan came in, and Ann Gorsuch, and they were bent on destruction and did a lot of destruction. At that time, I was in charge of a, called a Special Programs and Policy Staff. It was like a small staff office answering to the Assistant Administrator for Enforcement. Handle all the training, handle a lot of the penalty kinds of issues, a lot of the broad policy stuff the enforcement office did. When Ann came in, Ann Gorsuch, one of the first things she did was to demolish the enforcement office.
Which you were working in at the time.
And I'm not an attorney, but doing all the policy stuff. What they did was they stripped all of the attorneys out.
Okay.
And moved them to the various program offices. And then basically disaggregated the Office of Enforcement. What that did was two things. First, it stopped all enforcement. Then enforcement cases, there were no attorneys to work on them. Everybody's confused. Everybody's kind of confused, didn't know what they were doing. Second thing it did is it left me alone, basically as a career guy, non-attorney, working for political people in the middle of Gorsuch. At a time when the Democrats had control of both houses of Congress, were doing all kinds of inquisitions and stuff on Ann. She was a very, very unpleasant person. And she would get extremely angry. I was physically assaulted.
Oh, wow.
Sorry
to hear that.
You didn't do it.
No, the
assistant administrator or the associate administrator for congressional affairs physically picked me up and threw me against a wall because he was frustrated that something was late.
Wow.
I was myself, without permission, without talking to people, literally physically picking up enforcement cases I could get from the regions and walking them down the street to DOJ.
Wow.
And moving them into Steve Ramsey's inbox over there, because Steve was in charge of all the the environmental enforcement at DOJ. So it was just, it was untenable. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. It was time to go.
So that was so 2 years under Reagan, or I guess a year
right.
or so under Reagan.
Right.
And that year afterwards, you were saying, try something new.
That's right. Yeah, I was gone 3 years, really, but just under 3 years.
And so during that time period, you saw people around you. You said the attorneys were being sent different places across the United States. Were other people very close to your division feeling, I'm guessing, in a similar way?
It was awful. It was terrible. A lot of people left. They kept lists. And I don't know if this new administration is going to do this or not. They might. But they had a, when Ann came in, they had a whole bunch of kind of Schedule C appointees, they call them, which are not subject to congressional confirmation. They're just employees. You know what Schedule C is?
I've heard of it, if you are willing to.
Schedule C, wait, Schedule C?
I feel like I've got this wrong.
What is it? It is Schedule C.
Like temporary people coming
in? They're temporary people serving at the pleasure of the president.
Okay.
And every administration has them. They're all there.
Head team, is it similar to what that
would? Staffers, secretaries, special assistants, gophers, person,
okay.
you know, kind of making your, maintaining your calendar, lots of people stuff. If you're an assistant administrator or you're the administrator, you need little support people around you to just kind of make life workable.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that the issues are properly teed up for you, that meetings are properly prepared before you have to have them, that kind of stuff. But Ann Gorsuch and her people had a lot of those Schedule C's, and one of them in particular was appointed to find out who in the bureaucracy was not with the president.
Oh.
So he went down to the lists, down to the official files of all the employee files down in personnel office, put together a list of people who had ever, anywhere in their record, shown any evidence of working for an environmental organization, for having worked for a Democratic organization, having any leanings towards Democratic
wow.
kinds of things, any sort of thing that might indicate that they were not with the president, kept a list. And in Schedule A, which is attorneys,
okay.
they also do not have lifetime tenure. They still don't. Attorneys can be dismissed at will. And during this reorganization process, they were stripped out.
Wow.
They were not invited to continue on and had to go find another job.
So actually let go.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, wow.
See, people have this idea that like you're a federal person, well, you've got lifetime tenure and nobody can do anything about it.
Career.
Forget about it.
This even applied to career employees, though.
Exactly. These are career attorneys. It sort of depends how you're done. Now, I personally, as a manager, have fired plenty of people. Absolutely, you can get one. In this case, for attorneys in Schedule A, they can be let go at will. Okay? And they did. So morale was unbelievable. Now, there's a guy named Bob Perry, who was the general counsel appointed by Ann Gorsuch. He had literally a green-colored book. It was known as the Green Book.
Okay.
And he would keep notes on who he didn't like. And
actually,
by this time,
wow.
EPA was leaking like crazy. Again, a Democratic Congress, Democratic Senate. John Dingell was in charge of one of a really important committee up there in the House.
Okay.
With subpoena power. People are leaking like crazy, sending all kinds of stuff out. So John Dingell sent a subpoena for that Green Book.
Oh, wow.
All the stuff went to the Hill. And Bob Perry resigned instantly.
Okay.
It was right in here that Ann Gorsuch resigned. Unbelievable party. Unbelievable party. Unbelievable.
An actual party.
Yeah.
So at
this time...
Oh, my goodness,
it went all day long.
The House and the Senate actually were trying to save the
yeah.
EPA?
Yeah, they were very active. Because people were sending all the stuff out.
Okay.
On budget cuts,
okay.
on the Green Book, for example. It was very personal. It was very vindictive. This stands out as by far the worst transition I have ever heard of from any federal agency in my life.
Wow.
No matter what happens with this one, I promise you it's going to be better.
Well, there's no green book as far as we know.
They're smarter.
Wow.
But anyway, this is actually a question about how was morale? It was awful. It was really bad.
You said...
Everybody knew. I got a call from Mike Wallace.
Wow.
The whole 60 Minutes thing and this stuff. It was not good.
Wow. The look for anybody who's not with Reagan, did that influence you as
no.
well? Because I guess you hadn't worked for an environment
organization. No, and honestly, it didn't. Because my attitude was and still is, if you're working for somebody, you're working for them. If you're going to take their paycheck, you do work for him. I worked for Ronald Reagan.
That's true.
I did. That's one reason I left. I didn't want to do it anymore. But at the time I was taking this paycheck, I worked for him.
People don't think like that as much anymore.
Some people. That's not correct. I don't agree with that.
You don't think so?
Not anybody I know.
Maybe just the younger generation.
It pisses them off. No, I know lots of people.
Who work for the president. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This is just me inserting my beliefs then. Sorry.
It's how you'd feel. But
I agree that it's good that you work for your boss.
And if you don't want to,
I think
well,
it's respectable.
Leave. No, go work for somebody else.
Very good and respectful thing.
Yeah. But your real question is how did that affect me? Not too much. I was not. Like even when Mike Wallace called, I wouldn't talk to him. I didn't talk to him about this. That to me is family stuff. I'd had all my apologies, like when this guy picked me up and threw me against the wall.
Okay.
It was truly mortifying. There were all kinds of witnesses. The general counsel came to me, the enforcement counsel,
wow.
all these political people, everybody came and the person that did the assault, they were abjectly apologetic. They knew they had screwed up. And so I had done it. And then after all that, Mike Wallace calls and wants the story. And I'm family at that point. I'm not going to do that.
So people respected
it. They trusted me.
At that point, you had forgiven the person who did that and didn't want to keep talking about it?
Well, I'm not sure about the forgiven part.
But
it was past. It was done. They had done what they had to do.
But so that's...
So it was wild. That's 80s.
Sounds like a crazy ride.
That's 80s. And if what this is all about is transition, this marks, the worst.
Yeah. And so that would have started 81, the transition to Reagan.
Yeah.
So you did that for a year. You had said before that you were working with this smelting and water project.
Right.
Had that job changed up until then? Or was it the same?
I was still doing it.
The same.
No, what did I do? Oh, I know what I did. I took... I did that for 2 or 3 years for effluent guidelines,
okay.
And then I took, this is before the Reagan election, I took 9 months off just without pay and went around the world by myself.
Wow.
Because I wanted to.
Where did you visit? That's really cool. Not about transition, sorry, I'm just really curious.
But it's where do you go? I spent 6 weeks in Alaska and
wow.
spent 3 weeks in a kayak in Glacier Bay.
That sounds amazing.
And Kodiak Island, lots of hiking in the interior. Thailand, a lot of hiking in Nepal. Spent a month in India and Israel.
Wow.
And I'm not Jewish. I loved it.
Wow.
I just had the best time.
That's amazing.
So I just needed time. So I took time and did that.
9 months. And then I guess it would have been
Then I came back to... to a job in enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where I was when Reagan was elected.
Okay, enforcement relating to water or just...
No, it was a little small policy office.
Okay.
It's called the Special Programs and Policy Staff, and it was a little policy office working for the assistant administrator for enforcement, doing all the kind of broad cross-cutting kinds of things dealing with enforcement, because everything is partitioned because there's all these different statutes, pesticides, Superfund hadn't been passed, or neither in RCRA for that matter, but clean water, clean air, noise, they had a noise act then.
Mm-hmm.
They had, everything is partitioned, but I was doing all the sort of integrating, cross-cutting stuff. For example, penalties, how you assess penalties, on what basis do you decide what the charge should be for somebody that has been violating, such a pollutant with such a risk, mm-hmm. for such a length of time, with such a degree of intention, how do you say this should be equitable? whether it's pesticides or whether it's air, whether it's water. So it was really the cross-cutting kind of stuff like that. That was pretty fun.
And so you said a few of those factors. That was your group that then would take all
these
together.
And that's the one I was heading when Ann came in and ripped apart the enforcement office.
Right.
And we were mostly not attorneys.
Did that change, you said Ann came in, that sounds like it was a big point of change.
Absolutely.
Was it, did this sort of all happen within a week or so of her nomination, or was it more of a slow-moving change? How fast did you feel it?
8 months.
8 months.
That's standard issue.
Okay.
At least 8-10 months is what the transitions take.
From when she was appointed to when you started?
Confirmed, yeah. And then she shows up. It's like now Scott's here. Mm-hmm. But how many people does he have working for him right now? And I talk to people all the time at senior career levels at EPA, and a lot of them are eligible for retirement. They're all trying to figure out, when can I go? Mm-hmm. When should I go? What does this work for? How is this going to work for continuity? What about my people?
Right.
When can I get fucking out of here? It's like they're very stressed.
Because they're worried about somebody taking over their job?
They just hate it. They know the budget stuff is coming. Their jobs, at a senior management level, your job is mostly budget. Mm-hmm. You set direction, you kind of manage the crises, you make sure the large objectives are set and kind of done. But budget is the big thing, because nobody under you can do anything at all unless they exist. And you gotta have the position for them, you gotta have contractors support, all kind of stuff. So right now is extremely difficult for folks. And you know, it's like they all wanna know when can I go, and the answer that I tell everybody is, you will not be ready to go until this calendar year is done. It'll be October, November at least, until the new people are in and settled and the budget is all settled out. Okay. And you've got some continuity so that you can go. You cannot go now. You just can't.
And they don't want to leave because there is no continuity, because nobody will take over their projects, or because of a different reason?
They're people. You know, how would you feel? I don't know, you've been out of college, what, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah.
So you're trying to make a career here. You know, you're working like really hard. You don't know what your future is or anything. You don't know where things are going to go, but you want to contribute. How would you feel? You know, you'd be very insecure. You don't know that your job's going to exist. You don't know, I mean, this good-for-nothing president we got, his rhetoric is to break EPA into itty-bitty pieces and leave a few pieces maybe, but get rid of most of them. What's going to happen? Pesticide program came from ag, it could go back to ag. EPA was created by an act of Congress. It could be destroyed by an act of Congress.
Right.
It could.
No, yeah.
And so what do you feel? How are you? And you got 150 people working for you, and you're a manager. But a lot of people, like, you need to keep motivated. You want to keep working. You cannot walk out. You just can't. You can't during transition.
Do you think that actually is really, like, hearing it from your perspective is interesting. With people being afraid to leave as well, do you think part of that is because they're afraid that if they leave their job, then that job will no longer exist? Is that any of it? You think just that the continuity won't be there?
Who are you talking about here? You're talking about
just
the senior
in
folks
general.
Or
I guess mid-level to senior, like, just, this is just something I was curious about.
No, it's more of the care about the mission.
Okay.
You're there in the first place. You're working to do this by choice. It's like your job at the energy company. You're doing it by choice. You don't have to do this.
Absolutely.
Get another job if you wanted it. But they're there by choice because they care about it. And there is a mission. There's a job to be done. And there's a lot of fat that can be cut. Nobody would say that EPA couldn't take a haircut. But, but demolish it, break into bitty pieces? Well, that's pretty extreme. What about, what's it going to really be? You don't know. It makes people feel insecure. But meanwhile, you're a manager. You want to keep people working. Mm-hmm. The mission does matter. There's still the statutory deadlines I talked about before, where things have to be done by such and such a date. You've got court orders that have to be fulfilled.
And that's still up to today.
Yep, absolutely. Under the Air Act and the Water Act especially.
Right.
And other things like Superfund, that one is litigation driven. And so just the whole cycle of CERCLA is kind of driven more by the litigating marketplace. But nonetheless, there's deadlines, there's things have to be done. Those cases exist. Those sites are on the MPL. They've been named. Active ingredients for pesticides, they've got to be registered.
Right.
You know, the agricultural structure of this country falls apart if it is not regulated for safety. You get the bad ones out of there and get the new chemistries marketed and on. Brand new Tosca. Tosca just passed last year with all kinds of new requirements in it for EPA. So you're a manager at a senior level.
Mm-hmm.
These times are like really, really hard because you don't know about the budget, especially. You don't know who you're going to be working with. Personalities matter hugely.
Right.
You've got responsibilities to people who you like, respect, and want to motivate. So, you know, that's just a tough spot for everybody. It's going to be 10 months at least, into this calendar year before things settle.
And that was sort of how, jumping back to the Reagan position, you think that was about the same time
probably,
frame?
Probably.
When things started actually.
Yeah, the better analog is during the transition from Clinton to Bush.
Okay.
Because by that time I was an office director. I was in charge of Office of Science and Technology over here, which had all the effluent guidelines, had all the water quality standards, had all the beach programs, all the fish advisories, had all this other stuff. Water quality risk assessment for drinking water, all your drinking water numbers, everything like that. Streams, rivers, lakes, all the kind of what constitutes clean water for a long list of pollutants. We did all the risk assessments, analytical methods, everything. 150 people.
Okay.
At that point, from Clinton into George W. Bush.
150 people involved on that process.
On that, in my office.
Okay.
So at this point,
you're managing that team.
Yeah, right. I'm senior career at this point.
Yes.
So that in the end, the fear at this part of the cycle, the fear 100 days in, was equal to Reagan and equal to what it is now. Great fear, because George W. Bush was no friend of the environment when he came in. He campaigned against EPA. His agenda was very conservative, anti-environmental, yada, yada, yada. You could go on and read in anything you wanted into, and other issues people cared about.
Yeah.
But in the end, when Governor Whitman came in, and her deputy, Linda Fisher, as well as his assistant administrators, those people were just excellent people. They were thoughtful, they listened, they understood what had to be done. Basics like statutory deadlines, legal liability,
okay.
Takes X number of dollars in order to perform a job. We just totally lucked out.
This was in the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. And to Bush 43.
Yeah.
Bush 43.
And this was one of the big differences between that and the Reagan years.
That's right.
Years.
And I'm making the analog to Trump now. Because the time at the transition is the time of greatest fear.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. You don't know about the budget. You don't know about the people that are coming. You don't know about organizational issues or kind of
everything.
Or vindictiveness. Like the example I gave you of the guy whose name was Bob Crouch, who kept all the names of people, or Bob Perry, those guys that did, that was so vindictive and so personal. Personalities matter. And right now, and during a transition for the first 8 to 10 months or so, you don't know the people.
Right.
The only thing people know right now is Scott Pruitt sued EPA a bunch of times.
And that's what they're basing it off of, you think?
Yeah, mostly. They're very fearful of that.
But it's really interesting, though, with Reagan, with the transition into Reagan versus into Bush 43, you said the personalities made a huge difference.
So different.
Why do you think, I guess you said, I didn't write out her name, but with coming into Bush...
Governor Whitman?
Whitman, yeah.
Yeah, that's Christine Todd Whitman.
That was a lot better. Do you think that was just the luck of the draw?
Yeah,
or
I
that
do.
Bush knew what he was
doing? I do. It was luck of the draw.
Okay.
She was an up-and-coming... she was formerly the governor of New Jersey.
Republican. Okay.
And spoke in one of the nominating speeches for Bush. Real up and coming Kind of Republican.
I'm surprised I haven't heard of her more. I should have.
There's reasons for that. But she was very moderate, very moderate. And Bush had some political IOUs to do. And he talked her into doing the EPA job. Nobody wanted it.
Really? Nobody wanted it?
It's a penny, any kind of, you know, small potatoes kind of. You're asked to be attorney general or head this.
Yeah. Department of Justice or defense.
Yeah, DOJ or like agriculture with like 400,000 employees. You can do this penny any, you know. But anyway, she talked. But she was very moderate, very progressive. And the right wing part of the Republican just hated her. She lasted 2 years before she was forced out.
So she was too moderate for them.
Oh yeah, by far. But so it was luck of the draw, would be what I would say. It was luck of the draw. And the people that brought in to support her were just... But the fact is, the people that came in were just... They were good listeners. They were thoughtful, smart. Okay. They were not go out and regulate everything any which way. But they were lawyers. They'd do their homework. All of them. Very experienced managers in industry and elsewhere.
And that was the team that she picked.
Mm-hmm.
So she picked... I guess, in your opinion, a very good team.
Yeah. And that's the lesson. It's like, who are these people are makes all the difference. And that is still not known, Scott. To me, the jury's out with Scott.
We don't know what's going to happen yet.
No. I mean, I'm fairly plugged into the rumor mill on, you know, who's in the running for which position. But it's like, it doesn't matter.
I guess you don't know until you know.
Well, it's not only that. It's whoever you think it's going to be, what's not them. It's definitely not anybody you ever heard of before. It's always somebody from left field. So that's the suspended animation at the moment, and that's the most difficult part of transitions in a lot of ways. It isn't politics like, well, this president really demolish EPA to the point where it's just pieces left. But he said that repeatedly in the campaign trail.
Yeah.
No, he's not going to do that. He'll never get that through Congress. Will he bring
even a Republican Congress?
No way.
You know, I mean, I'm curious more about this. I guess with
even Republican Congress.
We were talking before there were, you know, Democrat House, Democrat
and Senate. Right.
Now with the Republican House and Senate, how do you think that will play differently this time? And this is all, I guess.
Well, what
sorry
it means
if you don't
is
know completely, but
well, that could be a whole long discussion itself. But there are. What it means first is that there's no easy platform for EPA people or advocates in EPA's favor to make their case against the president, because the Democratic House and Senate in the Republican years was a phenomenal platform for people that hated Reagan, the environmentalists and everybody else, to get their story out about the guy who kept the green book.
Right.
Have an investigation. You know, da-da-da-da-da. They had investigations out the wazoo, and that's why. And Gorsuch left, I think, 7 or 8 people left.
She left after 2 years, you were saying, approximately?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
so by the time you got back to the EPA after that, she was already gone.
She was gone. Yeah, I think 7 people were forced to resign. One person went to prison.
Wow.
Rita Lavelle. But that was, it's like, you know, what we just went through a couple years ago with the Republican House and Senate on Benghazi and Clinton's emails. You know how they were just on it all the time?
Yeah.
Because there was a political purpose to it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing.
But
just
flipped. Yeah.
See, so right now, people who would like to make the case in favor of EPA do not have that platform. That's the main point I'm making here.
That makes sense.
They're not going to have that. They can't do it. They get it New York Times, yada, yada, yada. They get the story out. And then secondly is, do people actually care as much now as they did before? EPA has made a lot of missteps. It's gotten into land use issues, particularly in wetlands, individual property rights kinds of problems have cropped up enough with EPA on the wrong side of things. With a lot of negative press of hurting people, negative press on costing coal miners their jobs, which EPA did not do a good job.
And we talked about some of the reasons.
No, but the main point is EPA did not counter it.
Okay.
That's still the public perception. EPA cost all those jobs. It didn't cost it. But that's the perception. So at this point, the climate, the political climate right now is not in favor of EPA. I think the upshot is EPA will take a substantial budget cut. I would think in the order of a third before it's done.
Okay.
Will they demolish it, break it into pieces, send it someplace else so EPA no longer exists? No. Will it be functioning? Yeah, sure. Will it be really aggressive and really active? Probably not.
And a lot of that has to do with probably funding. If you don't have the
funding,
to actually
budget, and people. That's it. That's the entire thing in the transitions.
A separate part of this project is looking into budgets, so I think that's pretty interesting.
Budgets really matter.
Yeah.
They really matter.
Money
and
speaks.
The OMB pass back that just happened, I think it was an 18% cut, that'll likely stand and get trimmed slightly. Because a lot of that was going to come from funds that go to states and for infrastructure, for example, the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund or the Clean Water Revolving Loan Funds that basically finance the construction of facilities for drinking water treatment and sewage treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they took the big cut. Infrastructure. Who gets that money? Jobs, yada, yada, yada. Some of that will be restored.
Okay.
What will not be restored are the cuts to the staff. That's what I think. So you're going to be looking at a smaller, trimmer EPA. They won't get it all in 1 year. They will get it all in 3 or 4 years. Especially if they keep the Senate 2 years from now. So it's going to be tough times for these folks.
Yeah. That, without speculating too much in the future, I think I'm going to come back to this actually at the end to pick into your mind a little bit more about what you think sort of where the EPA stands and where is it going. Before we get too far ahead with time, I'd love to jump back to your after Jakarta, Nairobi. You were saying you stopped working for, I think, enforcement you were saying you were doing at the time,
mm-hmm.
and then took your 2 years, just so I can get the timeline before we come back to some of the more transition
really
type things.
Yeah.
The years after Jakarta, where did that bring you back to the EPA? And you said that was...
I took a job at, it's a middle management level called a branch chief.
Okay.
It's, there were sort of... You had your staff grunts, which is a great job. You had what
you
called,
speak fondly
what
of it.
Called, huh?
You
I
speak
love
fondly
it.
Of it.
I do. I think,
yeah.
What are you doing?
You get the job.
You're a staff grunt.
I'm an analyst.
You like your job?
Love it.
Yeah, the end. So it's like that. You got people like that love their jobs. And then I had groups of like 5 to 6 or so called section chiefs at the time. And then 2 or 3 sections would make a branch. It would be like 18 people, 18, 15, 18 people you'd be managing. I came in as a branch chief.
Okay.
18 people doing it, and the permits, handling all industrial permits for, how do I attach something? I keep forgetting. Ah, add attachment. I'm going to take a second to send it because it has a whole sequence there.
Yeah, then I can focus more on your experiences.
You can also download it real quick. Okay, I just sent it to you.
Thank you.
I think, unless I screwed up.
So then after that...
So anyway, I came back in charge of all industrial water pollution permits, NPDES discharge permits.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was without Gorsuch at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And how leaving from that climate...
Yeah, because Bill Ruckelshaus came back.
Right, I remember, yes.
Yeah, after after Ann was fired. Wait, is that right? That's not right.
He came back later, I think.
He came back later because Reagan fired Ruckelshaus from Justice. When he, part of the Saturday Night Massacre. It was really messy.
I can check on that.
I know what. It was after the next election. It was 76. So Carter was in. Lee Thomas was there. Lee was great.
Okay.
That's what it was.
And your experience then, it's still Reagan, but with this new head of the EPA, mm-hmm. was it more
Lee
positive?
Thomas.
Is it different? Lee Thomas.
Yeah.
How do you feel that your mission then at that point was supported?
Mm-hmm.
Was it easier to get the resources you needed, or in general, what were your feelings?
Pretty straightforward. Yes, it was. This was the Carter administration, and Lee Thomas, I forget where he came from, but he was a sound, very thoughtful manager. Carter had this chief of budget named Bert Lance, L-A-N-C-E. He had this whole theory on zero-based budgeting, where all budgets for a succeeding year would have to balance out to the same amount as in preceding years.
Okay.
And you could do that by literally kind of have a big white magnetic board. You would take these tasks and these jobs, these budget areas, and you'd had to assign resources to it. You can move them around.
Okay.
You could kind of have this line which was zero. And so you could have all the things below the line that
reallocating
were... Reallocating. Yeah, to allocate your budgets according to all these different tasks that had to be done. And then you'd have certain things above the line which would be extra if you could get more resources.
Okay.
But the idea was you just got cut off at the line, which is the same line as you had previously. You can move your tasks and jobs around. It's actually kind of nifty in its way.
That is.
That was zero-based budgeting. It would end up being these kind of complicated and really kind of funny kinds of meetings sometimes where you'd have these managers together with these big magnetic boards and these little things you'd write things on. Because you could game it. Never gaming. There was gaming. Still, it was the idea, though, at its core, which is no more resources next year than you got this year.
And
if you want more resources, then it better have a damn good reason, and where's it going to come from? And that actually is not different from some of the Republican ideas now on zero growth of the federal government. It's zero based.
Same work. The same.
And
that's
right.
I'm guessing not including inflation. It's just the same amount.
I don't remember.
Either way, that's still the same
idea.
I
don't remember that part.
Still the same idea.
Play with it that way, and there's stuff around the edges like inflation. But the idea, but in terms of how things operated, it was sensible. You could do this. You could have discussions. Do I want to do this or do I want to do that? I don't have. Mm-hmm. I got 18 people now, and I can do this amount of stuff, and I can get you these rules, and I can get you these guidelines, and I can get you this document, we can have these meetings, and we can do this stuff. If I had 25 people, I could do this, and if you cut me to 15, then this is what you're going to have to give up. And you could have, intelligent discussions about it.
Great.
In terms of climate, working, stuff like that, good quality people, just excellent people.
And here you know you're having that set amount of funding, even if it's not more
right.
than you want, but you have it.
Right. And at most, you knew you'd get cut back to 5%, possibly 10%. There'd be some shuffling around within the different accounts at EPA and so forth. But it was rational. And that's what was different from Ann Gorsuch. That was irrational.
So you feel that those, a year remaining, no, more than that, you would have had longer. Your remaining time with Reagan was pretty good? In general, you feel like you got stuff done.
Reagan?
Would this be Bush at this point already?
Where are we?
After
Lee Jakarta. Thomas.
After Oh, this is later.
Lee Thomas. Yeah.
Can you give me a year for that? Just approximately.
I think 84.
Okay, so that would have still been...
Yeah, that's when Carter came in.
That would have been Carter. Okay.
Yeah, 84.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Got it. So this is still earlier.
Right.
Okay. Sorry, I had jumped in my head.
That's okay. Sorry,
no, I
have been doing a lot
sure
of transitions.
No, it's true. You have. It's great. Great. So the Carter transition, I guess, if it is useful, we could go through individual transitions, but I want to focus on the most interesting ones to you.
Yeah, the big ones were absolutely Reagan, George W. Bush, and Trump.
Yeah, and... I say I want to go through the most interesting ones, but just stepping back with the, I guess, other transitions that you've experienced that were not so notable in your mind, what do you think contributed to them being
making them remarkable?
More relaxed?
Well, let's do See, after Carter was Bush 41. And that was Russ Train. And what contributed to making him sort of unremarkable, was that the word you used?
Yeah, just, I guess, more standard.
He came from World Wildlife Fund. He is a conservationist. He was born and died one. When he left EPA, he went back to World Wildlife Fund. Wonderful, wonderful, soulful man. Very conservative. And I really hope I don't have my people mixed up, but I don't think I do. Russ Train. He was George H.W. Bush, I think.
We can fact check too.
Yeah, we need to make sure, because these guys do kind of blur together, and I apologize for that.
No, this.
But Russ Train.
Your remarkable is pretty amazing.
But Russ Train was he was World Wildlife Fund, a conservationist, cared a lot about the eco side of things, which I care a lot about. Everything's human health, cancer, yada yada yada. Toxicity as any pollutant affects you, but the eco stuff in a lot of ways is more interesting in terms of how you change the environment, what does it really do to ecological structures and so forth. Russ ate this stuff up. He was really good at it. And things like wetlands conservation, stuff like that, it was an easy sell. Mm-hmm. He got it. And the Bush 41 administration was not hostile to EPA. They just weren't hostile to it. It wasn't a political...
That wasn't part of his...
Wasn't a football...
agenda.
Yeah, wasn't part of the narrative.
Do you think that had to do with Bush's platform, or just the general state of how people were thinking about
the EPA? I don't
know
the answer to that. I don't know.
That is a broad question.
At this point, we're mid-80s.
Yeah.
I don't think the war in Kuwait had happened yet. But there were, it just sort of wasn't something that people were worked up about. It wasn't part of the narrative. He didn't get elected on a, rip EPA apart kind of platform like Trump did. He wasn't a hostile person at all. His people were good people. And same when Clinton came in. When Clinton came in, it was like more of the same. It was like, honestly, not, you couldn't say, oh boy, Republicans are bad, Democrats are good, or vice versa. You couldn't say it depending on any point of view you might have. There was good continuity, people with good conservation credentials, good experience. Carol Browner. I can't remember where Carol came from. That's so weird. I love her to death. She was just excellent.
So that was actually a relatively smooth transition.
Carol, I think, came from CEQ. She had been at CEQ before. My memory is right. Again, it doesn't matter. But the main thing I'm saying, what I say is she's got, there was continuity. These were experienced people. They were experienced managers. And Gorsuch, for example, to go back to her, she had never managed anything. She was an attorney for a phone company.
Okay.
In Denver. She managed five attorneys doing litigation in the Denver office of the local phone company.
Okay.
She came here to manage 15,000 people.
It's a big difference.
And the white-hot Kleeblites of Congress with hostile Senate. She was totally over her head. She had no experience. She had no idea about managing people. These guys, they had a good value set. They understand about laying out missions, what we're all here for, trying to keep people motivated. All people just generally in the same rail yard, on the same set of tracks, trying to work towards common destinations. And managing people at scale and dealing with politics. So Carol, when she came in, she was smooth as silk, just as easy as it could be. And the quality of people she brought in are just superb.
Wow.
I still work with some of them. Absolutely superb.
That's great.
All experienced people that understood how to operate organizations, would listen. If you push back on something, they'd give you a fair hearing. If they disagreed with you, they would say, well, I'm sorry, can't do it, and here's why. And a lot of times they'd be right.
That's really great. Yeah.
It was fine. You could talk to them.
It affected the quality of your work.
Absolutely.
Positively.
Right. And especially as a manager, and this was jumping ahead a bit to Governor Whitman, there were a bunch of things, because over here, in the Office of Science and Technology, I had all the effluent guidelines, all of them. And we had court orders like you wouldn't believe. They were just incredible because the previous manager just hadn't done it, as simple as that. And these guys, George W. Bush comes in bent to stop regulation, start throttling back on regulation. This EPA was in the crosshairs for George W. Bush. So there were a bunch of things that we needed to do, that we wanted to do, that we just couldn't for political
reasons.
Before
he came in? Before Bush 2 came in?
No, after Bush 2 came in.
After Bush, okay.
And we just couldn't after he came in because he was there and because there were political calls to say, we really can't get this through, we can't do it, and here's why. So I'd be the guy, as a senior career guy, having to go back and explain to you as a division manager or something like that, look, this isn't going to fly. I cannot get it done, and here's why. I gave it the old college try. But the nice thing about Governor Whitman and Russ Train and all his people and everybody like that before them is that even when they didn't agree with you, they could explain to you the reasons why. And in many cases would come up with something that was second best, but that you could do.
And that's a big difference than moving into Bush. They would not give you a good reason for why they couldn't do something? How would that conversation
would.
Be different?
No, but they would in Bush.
Oh, they would.
Yeah, Governor Whitman and her people were just excellent. They when they had to give you bad news, and they did give me bad news. There were a bunch of things you just couldn't do. Wasn't going to happen. It just was not going to make it through the White House. The call had been made at the presidential level. It was not going to happen. I'm thinking in particular of a $4 billion rule that needed to be moved for construction and development. It was not going to happen.
Because the funding wasn't there?
No, because it was politically unacceptable to the White House.
Okay.
We're in a court order to propose a rule to deal with surface runoff of silt and sedimentation, just normal stuff from construction development of like big housing projects. And we wrote that rule. We had it all ready to go when they came in. And which is great. It was a good rule in a lot of ways. But there's this one little teeny tiny problem, and that is that the price tag on it was $4 billion,
The
B.
Yeah.
And that was going to interfere with people's use of land.
Okay.
It was. The EPA's coming in. It's going to regulate. We had a court order, had all the right reasons for doing it. And the White House made the call to stop that rule. It did not go out. We ended up withdrawing it.
And proposing. Whitman had to tell you that it was not approved?
Right.
Okay.
So Governor Whitman told me that this wasn't, she simply couldn't get it done. It was just way too much money. It was too much intrusion in people's lives. Mm-hmm. It simply wasn't going to happen. And we sat there and talked about how I was going to explain that to my staff. And in the end, we decided to propose to simply not act. It had to do with some fine print in the way the court order was written, because EPA had to make a decision. It didn't say what that decision was, and our decision was to not act.
Okay. So you didn't go against that.
Right. So we did not go back to court on that. We were then sued by the environmentalists for flagrantly violating the law. They actually won that suit. We were then compelled to write it anyway.
Wow.
But the tricky part, and I think what you're going at, is like, what was it like to work in it? And the thing is as a senior manager with all these people working for me, and they worked hard on this.
Well, you have an interesting perspective of needing to share with them the news of what has passed on.
Right. And the thing about Governor Whitman and her people, particularly a woman named Linda Fisher, who was her deputy, they were just so helpful to me in figuring out how to explain it. I understood it. $4 billion. This president wasn't going to do it.
Yeah. What was the name of that act, or of that
construction rule? Development.
Construction development.
Effluent guideline construction development. I can dig up more details for you if you want.
I'm interested. That's really interesting. I mean, just picturing sort of how you could have a helpful higher up to guide you through saying, no, this can't happen.
That's the difference. And when I keep saying people, 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 that's it. They understood my quandary.
I mean, I think I'm getting at what you're getting at.
Right. No, I understand. That is what it is. It's the people they sat there and worked it through. They knew I had a problem.
Regardless of whether you agree with it passing or not passing.
Right.
How you actually present that. Are there other examples of cases like that where, I guess, maybe you did not have such an easy way to share with the rest of your team, because you were just told no and not given a good reason, or
not that I can think
not in this case, or even earlier in your career, I guess you
were. No, the earlier session. Stuff, probably the biggest one, is simply the stoppage of enforcement during the Reagan years, mm-hmm. where they simply decided they didn't want to have environmental enforcement. It was pissing too many people off. That was their agenda. Jim Watt was over in Interior. He was ripping that place apart. Reagan came in, hell bent for leather, on, you know, kind of shrinking the federal government and getting rid of all these idiot kind of bureaucrats who tried to run people's lives for them. And but the decision to not do enforcement was sort of not reviewable. It was, they simply took a lot of actions to stop enforcement. So at that point, nobody explained anything to me. I just started physically walking the cases over to DOJ.
Right.
And gave them the cases so they could develop them, and
because
then they could
take. Because it was supportive DOJ at that point too.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, you said you walked them over to DOJ because they would actually pursue them.
Right. And just by way of background, yeah. EPA then and still doesn't prosecute its own cases. DOJ is the attorney for the government.
Okay.
Very few exceptions to that. If you screw up and do something really bad, and the federal government has to sue you,
it's from them.
Well, who's that? It's DOJ files that. EPA doesn't have independent power, with extreme exceptions, to file its own cases. Mm-hmm. So DOJ filed the cases. They weren't getting any cases from EPA. I walked them over and took them. I got them in from the regional offices and didn't tell a soul. I took them over.
Don't say anything about that. That's
true. They were terrible cases.
Jumping back to this example,
they were good cases, but just terrible, terrible facts that needed to be where they really did need to be brought.
And so in those cases, it would be then the government defending against environmental groups, or would it be the government defending who?
This is offense. This is government offense. This is enforcement.
Against who else?
Against whatever the violator might be.
Oh, okay. Okay.
For example, I can't think of a case right now, but there's just many, 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 many. Criminal. Dumping.
Okay.
Of hazardous waste down a drain.
Got it. So it would go from the EPA
to DOJ,
which
then brings the case. God, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank. There were just so many.
That's fine. I'm sure you've seen.
But it's offense. It's where a company, or even in some cases an individual, but mostly large companies,
mm-hmm.
Do something really bad that is illegal. Under the Clean Water Act, they have a permit, they have a discharge permit that says don't discharge more than X pounds for this per day. They discharge 150X per day.
Okay.
And on top of that, dump all kinds of stuff. Oh, I can think of one. There was one case in New Jersey of the company that made Agent Orange, where they would literally sweep out, they would submit all these discharge permits showing they were in compliance, and then at night, they would have people that would take these big piles of stuff and literally sweep them into the river, and they were filmed doing it. Well, that's,
so it didn't technically come out through the pipe or whatever.
Right.
But it came.
Right.
Wow.
So, but it was like criminal. It wasn't just, there's civil kinds of problems where you kind of just
a wrong number
do something wrong. Yeah, right. Discharge too much, and it should have been X instead of Y.
But then there's
intentional stuff.
Wow. So they knew they were.
But that's offense. That's what enforcement is all about. When EPA is sued by someone else and then you're in defense.
That's usually from an environmental group or
usually. A lot of times, but not only. Scott Pruitt sued EPA 16 times.
For having too strict regulations.
Yeah, they disagreed with whatever rule it was. I got sued all the time. We did so many rules. We got sued in all of them. We beat them all, too. We won them all.
Congratulations, I guess.
We never lost one.
Wow, that's actually impressive.
We did great on that stuff.
Wow.
But that's general counsel.
Mm-hmm.
General counsel would help with the with construction of the rules in the first place so they could be defended. And then DOJ and general counsel of EPA will handle the defense when you're done. But I'm talking about offense here when I talk about enforcement. This is when a company does something bad and EPA is taking an action against them.
And so a smaller EPA, just by nature of not having as many people out to do offensive measures, will probably be playing more defense.
I cannot imagine they'll keep up their enforcement
maybe.
Measures. I cannot imagine any scenario in which the enforcement of environmental statutes, air and water, hazardous waste, pesticides, toxic substances, all of them. I cannot imagine any scenario in which the current level of enforcement is maintained. I think with if budgets are cut at the level that they're talking about cutting them, mm-hmm. there's no way.
Moving just to get to present, and then I don't want to keep you too late, but also want to touch on the few last areas that we may have not gotten as far into. Bush 2, moving through Bush 2, you said had a pretty positive relationship with the highest up administrator. Moving to, the, I guess, in Obama, how was that change for you?
I had gone by that time.
Oh, so you had retired.
Yeah, I left in 2005.
Got it.
I left in 2005.
So you've been following it, but then you
Well, I've set up my own consulting business, been doing stuff. And I left, by the way, this was just...
Sorry, I didn't have everything, by the way. I apologize.
You don't need to apologize. You don't have to apologize. But this is more for you, so you can kind of do the time sequence here. No, it was right there. My kids were 12 and 15.
Okay.
And I had worked at EPA for long enough that I was eligible for early retirement at age 54.
Because you've been there a long time at that point.
Started when I was 21.
Yeah.
You know,
40 years?
Yeah, I mean, I got out of college when I was 21, and I was just...
It's like I worked at my job for 40 years.
Right, right. So I had done all that, and I was eligible, but our kids were 12 and 15. I was traveling all the time. I was extremely stressed all the time. It was very, very difficult at senior management jobs. And I got into one of these conversations with myself on, will I spend the rest of my life being happy I worked more, or being happy that I spent more time with my kids? So I left to be with my kids. And it's the best move I ever made.
That's great.
But I loved the work. And I had done it carefully, where I really had someone there to take over when I left. There was good succession. Started doing some consulting and do that about a quarter time, maybe.
Wow.
And for a while, it was a lot more than that, particularly when both kids were in college. But, you know, it was the best thing I ever did in my life, was to leave to be with my kids.
That's really great.
Even though I didn't like that president very much, by that time, Governor Whitman had gone, and a guy named Steve Johnson was administrator. I know Steve. He was a career guy.
Okay.
Steve's a good man, but I left because I could, and if I put it off anymore, I'd miss more of my daughter before she went off. And by the way, she ended up at Yale. So
that's fine. They're cool too. I said they're cool too.
Very, 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 very.
That's great.
Very. So, you know, so I just...
I feel like that's a great decision for you.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, like, you get into these kinds of things, what am I going to be sorry for then? Didn't work more or that I...
Yeah. My dad actually didn't
can't do that.
Stop but cut down on some hours, too, when we were in high school, which was really nice, because he had been working, like, 60 hours a week.
It was like that.
Yeah.
I was working enormous hours. I was getting up at, you know, 5 every day to get to the gym. I work often stress, and I get home at 7 or 8 at night and traveling all the time. And I loved my people. I loved my job. I loved the political people.
Yeah.
At that time, it was not
a political
adverse,
move at that
but it
point.
Was like I want to be.
And so this was
the best
guess,
thing I ever did.
A decision probably made over a couple of years of just more personal than actually having to do with the climate.
Yeah.
And you said you left your job in good hands. How did you follow that transition? Follow the person who took over your position to make sure that basically your group was taken care of and that they would be successful once you left?
Well, a lot of coffees, basically.
Okay.
A lot of coffees, a lot of lunch.
Coffee smells a lot of lunches,
a lot of things. Yeah. I was thinking about that, actually, just walking down here, because they're demolishing this office building up here now. Mm-hmm. And there used to be a Starbucks at the bottom of that thing.
Oh, wow.
And I was actually thinking about that. I was just walking by it, and I was like, oh, geez, there's a bit of my history there in that building. They're ripping out that Starbucks, ripping down the whole building. But no, just a lot of coffees, a lot of lunch. And my successor is now gone, and his successor is a woman named Betsy Sutherland.
Okay.
who's worked for me. I hired her at least twice, moved her into the senior executive service. She kept getting hired away from me because she was so good. She's just outstanding. And now she's the office director running the whole show.
Wow.
And I had lunch with her last week, and we're scheduled to have it again the first week in April.
That's really nice.
We talk all the time.
So you can stay in touch with her.
Well, they're just trying to find their way through, too. It's hard. She wasn't there during Reagan. There's a lot of fear. This goes back to the fear. She doesn't know who the people are. The budget stuff going on right now. Unbelievable fire drills you have to go through. It's like you have to not just kind of have your people kind of aware of what's going on. You want to share stuff. You do.
Yeah.
You're open. You're talking. She's very, very open. But you need to do all these fire drills of like they need to have by 5 o'clock tonight, and it's only 4:30, and I need this two-page write-up, and
Oh no!
And the administrator's asking.
So, like, actually, that still continues. I guess an interesting question I just thought of: you had gone through multiple transitions, or a few transitions before Reagan, and knew how to compare them to that. For somebody that hadn't been at the EPA as long, how do you think they're thinking about that?
At what
or
level?
How can you help?
At what level?
As far as like concern for their job or concern for if they're going to be able to.
But depend. When I mean what
job.
Level is like. Because I don't know of any senior manager that hasn't been through them. Honestly,
I guess
the senior managers
level.
Are pretty experienced. The main place you run into that with
like
the people
who they turn to for advice.
You mean people have been there like 4 or 5 years, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I talked to them too. They reach out. You know, they talk. How'd you find me? You know, you talk to.
Yeah.
I guess Chris talked to Louise Wise, and you know, Louise and I worked together quite a lot at one point, and think very highly. You know, I have lunch with her every now and then. It's like the network sort of begin, and it's the same with anybody that's in EPA. You find your way around. You know, people that have been around. You just ask them.